If the Olympics have made you more interested in China, we have some reading recommendations for you now from Anne-Marie Slaughter. She spent the past year living in China and traveling throughout the country. She's dean of the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. Here are her recommendations as part of our series, Three Books.
China's scale is so vast, its variety so great, and its rising power so apparent. It acts as an enormous magnet, fixing our attention. One result is a torrent of books. Start with Susan Shirk's China, Fragile Superpower. Shirk, a lifelong China expert, is a terrific guide. The China she describes is strong on the outside, but led by men who are chronically afraid of losing power. They're anxious and paranoid, and they've watched the collapse of communist and authoritarian regimes all around them. Unless our own leaders understand China's underlying fragility, we'll respond to their crises with a kind of hardline pressure that will trigger a dangerous response. So we'd better get this right. If you want to understand China's economic fault lines, pick up The China Price by Alexandra Harney. Harney shows us the real price of China's surging economy. Hundreds of thousands of workers are dying of work-related lung disease, an asbestos crisis on steroids. Factory managers explain that the only way to reconcile the conflicting demands of corporate social responsibility and competitive pricing is to falsify work records. And we meet the girls of room 817, a factory dorm room. One girl makes it from a peasant village to real estate agent in just a few years, but only one. The others are stuck, moving from one low-paying job to another. For every business book goggling at the rate and scale of China's growth, The China Price is a powerfully needed antidote. For my money, though, one of the deepest ways to understand China's present is by turning to its past. Snowflower and the Secret Fan, a novel by Lisa Si, takes us back 200 years to the Qing Dynasty. It's the world of Lily and her soulmate, Snowflower. After Lily's feet have been broken and bound for 2 years, she emerges with golden lilies, the beauty ideal of 3.5 centimeter feet. Letters between Lily and Snowflower over the years describe bed business, the quest for sons, and the destruction of a family by opium. But what they ultimately show is Lily's determination to achieve a better life for herself and her family. The story of Lily and Snowflower, like the girls of Room 817 today, portrays a people with a fierce determination to succeed and a mighty capacity for suffering along the way. The collision of those forces has produced revolution in China's history. China's rulers continually worry that it will again. That tension, when China has hosted the Olympics and is making its world debut as a rising superpower, is why these books should be on your reading list.
Anne-Marie Slaughter is dean of the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. She spent the last year living in China. She was recommending these three books, China, Fragile Superpower by Susan Shirk, The China Price by Alexandra Harney, and Snowflower and the Secret Fan by Lisa Si. You can find more Three Books recommendations at npr.org.
The U.S. Open Tennis Championship opens today in New York, and the woman player who wins will take home the same amount of prize money as the man who comes out on top. Tennis legend Billie Jean King can be largely thanked for that. 35 years ago, she led the fight for that bit of gender equality at the Open. It was a big year for tennis. 1973 also saw the tennis match billed as the Battle of the Sexes, where Billie Jean King faced Bobby Riggs, a flamboyant one-time tennis star. He'd challenged King with the taunt that men were simply the superior athletes. That match is at the heart of King's new book, Pressure is a Privilege, Lessons I've Learned from Life in the Battle of the Sexes. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
Let's get to the match in just a moment, but a little background. Bobby Riggs had been trying to get you to play him for years when this finally happened in 1973, but you didn't want to play him.
No, because we just started women's professional tennis, and it was a very difficult time for us. We didn't have any infrastructure. So we were trying to get people to even hold tournaments, and Bobby kept saying, play me, play me. And I said, Bobby, and we're so busy. I'm so busy. I don't have time. So finally, he played Margaret Court, who, quite frankly, at the end of 73, was the number one player in the world. And he beat her like 6-2, 6-1. I mean, it was just annihilation, basically. And I wasn't there to see it, but it was amazing. When I came back from Japan and heard the score, I just said, well, I have to play him now.
The worry, of course, was that if Bobby Riggs' victory stood, it would undo what professional women tennis players had managed to gain. Which is how it happened that on the night of September 20th, 1973, Billie Jean King took on Bobby Riggs at the Houston Astrodome. Paint a scene for us of what it was like in the Houston Astrodome when you played Bobby Riggs. It was something of a three-ring circus.
It was. It was pure entertainment, which I love anyway. And we had all tons of celebrities there, and Glenn Campbell, and we had George Foreman was there. Bobby gave me a big sugar daddy because he was getting a lot of money from Nabisco, and then I gave him a piglet, a little baby, with a little bow around his little neck. He was so cute.
And that would have been male chauvinist pig.
Correct, totally.
And you came in on something like a throne.
Like an Egyptian litter, I guess they call it. I'm not sure. And then Bobby was in a rickshaw with his, bosom buddies.
His beautiful women. He had an entourage.
Yeah, total entourage. And I had the, the track team from Rice University holding me up. Thank God they were very strong. And because I'm a little afraid of heights. So that was like, please be careful.
Well, how did you beat him? What went on in your mind and also with your playing that you managed to pull this off quite handily?
Well, my preparation was impeccable. The day before the match, I went into the Astrodome to check it out because I knew it wasn't a normal tennis stadium, so I knew it was going to be very different. I met all the security guards. I knew where all the elevators were. I knew where my locker room was going to be. And so doesn't mean you're still going to win, but at least you've given yourself, you've played the percentages right.
Once you were actually on the court, did you play the game that you expected to play, that you planned out?
Well, we always talk about this. From the baseline to the umpire's chair, as we walked down the court after I got off that Egyptian litter, I thought, I know I should play my game, but I think what I'm going to do is have 5 rallies, and I don't care if I win the point, but I'm going to run him into the ground. And it doesn't matter if I win the point or not, but that I have to do, and I have to do it in the first set. I put everything into one set in my head, that first set, that I had to win it.
Well, when one sees film of this match, it does look like you ran Bobby Riggs right into the ground.
And I purposely hit the ball as softly as I could. Of course, we couldn't crack an egg in those days with our wooden rackets anyway, but I hit it. And the court was quite dead, meaning you have to get up to the ball. The ball hits and it stays low, and it doesn't come through the court. It doesn't penetrate through the court, so you have to really make an effort to go forward on every ball, and that you've got to get up to the ball so it doesn't drop too low.
Did your victory over Riggs have an immediate impact on women's tennis? I mean, that was such a show.
It actually had an impact on tennis. The men and the women's professional tours had the biggest attendance ever in 1974 because of it. We got our first network contracts because of it. And that's both men and women. It's funny how when a woman does something, they always think we only affect half of the population. And people will come up to me and say, thanks what you did for women's tennis all the time. And I know they'd never say that to a guy. If they walked up to a male, they would just say, thanks what you did for tennis. And it's interesting. I think people perceive women that way all the time. And that's not good. Because if you affect one human being, I think it's a domino effect. It changes the puzzle. It changes the framing, everything. And also what came from this match is the first generation of men of the women's movement. Because I have men coming up to me today that have daughters, and they have tears in their eyes, and they tell me how that match, they were 10 years old, 12 years old, 17 years old, and how that match changed their life and how they've raised their daughters. And they're the first generation of men that truly believe that their daughters and sons should have equal opportunity.
Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Billie Jean King's new book is called Pressure is a Privilege, Lessons I've Learned from Life and the Battle of the Sexes. And one final note on the spectacle of the Riggs King match. The broadcast of that match opened with the song Anything You Can Do, I Can Do Better. The song became famous many years earlier in the 1946 Broadway production Annie Get Your Gun. And here are the stars who originally sang it, Ethel Merman and Ray Middleton.
And now, little lady, if you'll kindly step up to the parapet, I'll give you a lesson in marksmanship.
You couldn't give me a lesson in long-distance spitting. Anything you can do better. I can do anything better than you.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
You know,
no,
Steve, I think we're beyond that kind of cross-gender volleying. I mean, it's not because I'm a woman that anything you can do, I can do better.
I was just sitting here thinking we should have some kind of a challenge, an interview challenge, and get celebrities to come and watch us ask questions.
Okay, top this. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
Writer Tony Giardina is a movie buff. Our series You Must Read This gives authors the chance to extol the virtues of one of their favorite reads, and Giardina's choice is about the old days of film. Reading the book left him with one of his favorite summer memories.
10 years ago, I discovered a book that gave me so much pleasure, I found I could only read it at one time of the day, in one place, and in one season. Early on a summer evening, I'd light the coals in my barbecue grill, sit back in my favorite chair in the garden, and open James Harvey's Movie Love in the 50s. It took about half an hour for the coals to get hot enough, so I read the book in half-hour increments over two or three summers, and I count those 30-minute increments as among the most pleasurable of my life. I can imagine there might be those who would question how a book called Movie Love in the 50s, a book whose subject is just what its title promises, could possibly be so ecstatically interesting. But maybe such people don't remember how different movies used to be a half century ago, when they weren't just giant technological marvels whose primary interest lies in how much money they gross on their opening weekends. Movies in the 50s weren't all pitched to the appetites of teenage boys. They were made for adults. And one of the marvels of Harvey's book is the way he opens up the adulthood of our parents and grandparents through the movies they went to see, movies that not only reflected their adult dilemmas and choices, but actually had a hand in shaping the kind of people they became. That's the key to Harvey's great book. It's not just about the movies. It's about the country we were 50 years ago, a country where the very white Lana Turner's relationship with her black maid in Imitation of Life, Montgomery Clift's relationship with Elizabeth Taylor in A Place in the Sun, and Janet Leigh's with her various bras in Psycho, all of these tweaked a post-war nation into thinking more deeply about how they felt about race and sex and fashion. Harvey manages to make us see how every movement in those movies counted and how much actors counted, how we relied on each of them for something specific. When he writes about the way Doris Day embodied our national will to happiness, he deepens the way we think about an actress like Day, showing us the bitter edge behind her highly worked-at cheerfulness. Her eyes look desolate, he writes, and when you watch her movies, you see just what he means. He's great, too, about the rebels, Brando, Clift, and James Dean, and the way girls flirting with rebels but marrying the suits constituted a code as to what it meant to grow up. As a little boy in the 50s, I can remember sitting in the back seat of my parents' car on long night journeys, catching sight through the trees off the sides of the highways, of images of Rock Hudson and Marilyn Monroe, James Stewart and Kim Novak, on the drive-in screens that were as ubiquitous then as McDonald's are today. I thought they were just alluring images in the dark. Harvey has made me realize that for my parents, those images were important signposts on a long, uncertain path.
Tony Giardina. His most recent novel is called White Guys, and you can read an excerpt from the book that he was recommending, Movie Love in the 50s, at npr.org.
When I was just a little girl, I asked my mother, what will I be?
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I am Netta Ulaby. This week on NPR's podcast, Book Tour, we'll hear author Ethan Cannon reading from his new novel, America, America. It examines power, class, and the drama of a political scandal in a small upstate New York town.
She's not wearing anything fancy, just her blue jumper and a peach blouse and black flats from work. Then Senator Henry Bonwiller arrives, and for some reason she's thrilled enough just to stare outright at him. He's standing in a small group of older gentlemen near the stage, talking to this one and that, gesturing with his large hands at all kinds of comers and goers, and when his eye falls on hers for a moment, then goes on, then comes back. She blushes and turns away. He knows I don't belong.
For the entire reading and discussion, and to hear other authors of fiction and nonfiction, please visit npr.org/booktour.
Back now with Day to Day and a car story, an old Mercedes-Benz story, and these can get bumpy. And I'm thinking, Madeline, that regular listeners may recall the eco-conversion performed by your husband, Joe, to get your old diesel to run on used vegetable oil.
Yes, my car and his car. And, you know, it's a good thing overall, but, you know, sometimes these things don't work out as well as you.
Occasionally you're late to work, but anyway. This yearning for the German Uber vehicle, really, it's a transcultural phenomenon. It's the story in a new book, My Mercedes is Not for Sale. I read it, and I wanted to talk with the author.
You would suppose that people in the poorest parts of the world wouldn't have a need for a Mercedes-Benz, right? But
yeah.
What I found when I went there is that, like, I could sell the car to almost anybody. I mean, everybody wanted to get into a Mercedes.
That's Jeroen van Berkjeck. And the thing is, his Mercedes was for sale. A lot of old Euro cars get shipped to Africa and sold there. Jeroen, a Dutch journalist, decided to drive his. He got what you might call a clunker, a 1988 190D, paid $1,200 for it. And then he drives through Europe and down to Spain, takes a ferry boat across to Morocco. And from there, it's a long way around the Sahara to his destination, West Africa.
Basically, when I pass the border of Morocco and you're like really getting into Africa, the border guy actually tried to persuade me to sell the car to him. And he sort of threatened to not let me into the country when I didn't sell the car to him. So yeah, I could sell the car almost anywhere, but yeah, then I wouldn't have a book, would I?
You wouldn't have a book. The journey continues. The road ends. You're driving through sand. Along the way, the car breaks down and you find out that actually there's some kind of infrastructure to repair these broken down old Mercedes-Benz.
Oh, yes, because in a country like Mauritania, I think there's like 50% of the cars on the road are this Mercedes-Benz, so the 190 model. The capital of Mauritania, Nouakchott, is like the capital of Mercedes-Benz in Africa. So you will find almost anywhere a mechanic who can fix this car. And that's also the reason that people really want to buy this car, because they can get it fixed everywhere. They basically set up shop in any patch of land, and the only tool they may have is a jack.
You have this kind of moment there in Ghana where you recognize you've come to a place that actually functions. It works. There are no aid workers. No one's trying to help these people out or anything. They have a real economy going there.
Yeah, it's a place called Swame Magazine, and it's a whole neighborhood of car mechanics living together. And it's like a scene from the Middle Ages. People all covered in oil, and it's dark, and it's ugly, and they just spill oil into the river. And so it's disgusting in one part. But on the other hand, I mean, this is a real vibrant economy. People all over West Africa come to this place to get their cars fixed. And that you don't find that much in Africa, that you get a feel of this is working and people feel proud of themselves to work in this place.
You've got a video up at YouTube. We'll link to it at our site, npr.org. Is this where you shot a part of this video? Because you're out in back of a garage there and you say, well, they do have parts here. And then you cut to this, just looks like a soccer field full of old engines, right, just kind of rusting out. In
the- I mean, that's amazing. I mean, there's a mechanic who only deals in transmissions or Mercedes transmissions or Toyota transmissions. Then there's a guy who only deals in hubcaps or in Toyota hubcaps or Renault hubcaps. So there's enormous specialization going on, and you can go there with like any car except American cars to get it fixed. I mean, I'm sorry to report, but basically in Africa, they drive everything except American cars.
Well, thank you for that, Jeroen.
Well,
you know, this book is really not about cars. It's about the people that you encounter and the discoveries that you make along the way. The road runs out at one point. The asphalt ends. You're crossing a border. You have to take on a guide. And this relationship doesn't work out all that well.
No, because I was sort of expecting an older person who could tell me about what I saw around me. What you expect from a guide, somebody who can tell you a little bit about what you see. I had all these visions of spending the night among camels in the dunes and under the stars.
And what you get is some 20-year-old kid gum-chewing, cigarette-smoking. He doesn't want to talk to you. He doesn't want anything to do with you.
No, he's basically interested in my my Tupac CD collection. And when we are looking for a place to camp, he dumps me right next to a diesel generator thing. And then I have to sleep in diesel fumes that night while I was imagining to have this wonderful night in the desert. So no, that didn't actually work out very well. No.
You're out in this kind of romantic experience that you imagine before the trip, but that's not what Africa turns out to be at all.
No, no, right. I mean, I have sort of a hate-love relationship with Africa. I mean, a lot of people who are after my money, but I can't really blame them because I would basically do the same if I were in their shoes to, I mean, here's a white guy in a Mercedes Benz. I mean, yeah, that's a target. That's pretty obvious. But I meet a lot of wonderful people. And there's, of course, going to Africa, you know, there's going to be misery. But what I find so attractive about Africa is the realization that all that stuff that you in the Western world worry about, your mortgage, your cars, your home, your job, that really doesn't matter. That's a wonderful experience for me.
I see you quoted as saying that you found the people that you met in many places seemed a lot happier than the people you know in Western Europe or when you've come to America.
Yes, I mean, when you come to America or to Holland, people are always complaining about something. And here are people who are really in a lot worse situations, and they don't seem to complain that much.
Jeroen van Berkjek did sell his Mercedes in the end. He got twice what he paid for it, along with a lesson about how the global economy really operates. His book is My Mercedes is Not for Sale. You can read excerpts and see video from his journey at our website, npr.org.
Lauren Child has been called a genius. She's also been a roamer with no fixed address, a lampshade maker, and a middle child. She's created some of the signature characters for contemporary children's literature with a sharp and distinct distillation of watercolor, cartoon, and collage, and finely tuned characters that capture the voices and imaginations of children. Like Charlie and Lola, the older brother and his little sister, who's small and very funny, who are seen on the Disney Channel in the U.S. and in countries around the world, from Australia to Malaysia to Zimbabwe, but always with those cute little accents.
Lola, Mum said it's time for bed now.
No, I am not sleepy and I will not go to bed.
So then I say,
but you must be slightly sleepy, Lola.
I am not slightly sleepy at 6 o'clock, or 7 o'clock, or 8 o'clock. I am still wide awake at 9, not at all tired at 10, or 11, and I will still be awake at midnight.
Another Lauren Child character is Clarice Bean. She's a little older, therefore she's got a lot more to worry about. The latest Clarice Bean book has just been published in the United States, Clarice Bean, Don't Look Now, by the Candlewick Press. Lauren Child joins us from the studios of NPR West. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Clarice Bean says it's the worry you haven't even thought to worry about that should worry you the most.
Yeah, well, I always think that that's probably true. I was a terribly big worrier when I was a child, and I still am, I think. And I wrote this book at a time when I kept waking up at sort of 4 a.m. worrying about all kinds of things, which make a lot of sense at 4 a.m, but don't seem at all rational when it's daylight.
Let me, if I could get you to give us a sample of the quality of things that young Clarice Bean worries about. Worry number 4, if I'm not mistaken, section of your book, if you could read that.
Sure. Lately, I've been having bigger worries. For example, i.e. worry number 4, the meaning of life. Why are we here? Is it just to be nice to everybody and have a nice time? Or do we have to come up with something clever, like doing a test or something? On one program I heard, they said space goes on and on forever without stopping, and how it has no edges, and they call it infinity. But what I want to know is, how can something go on and on forever without stopping? How can something have no edges? Am I just a tiny speck floating about with lots of other specks, i.e. planets and stars? Where does infinity end?
Lauren Child reading from her latest book, Clarice Bean, Don't Look Now. I said in the introduction, no fixed address, but you've done a book for UNESCO about a homeless rat. Were you once homeless in the streets of London?
It wasn't that dramatic. It was just that I was at a point in my life where it felt like too many things had collided. I'd written Clarice Bean and no one was interested. I didn't have a job. I tried lots of things and I'd made a bit of money and then the next thing collapsed. I never thought, oh my goodness, where am I going to go tonight? I'm going to be in a desperate situation. But you're always hoping someone will say, yeah, it's okay, you can borrow my house for a couple of weeks while we're on holiday. And you feel in people's way. And so I could suddenly understand how people who shouldn't end up on the street do end up on the street, because you'd rather have your own space than annoy people or be continually thanking people or, you know, begging a favour.
Are Clarice Bean and Charlie and Lola buds of yours? I mean, do you have dialogue with them or put them through experiences that never wind up in the books?
I mean, with Charlie and Lola, you're picking out the tiny, tiny things of a 7 and 4-year-old's life that might be big things to them. Mm-hmm. It's almost like doing haiku. That sounds very pretentious, but it's you're distilling something to its absolute essence, and you're trying to get mm-hmm. as fewer words in there as possible and make each word count. With Clarice Bean, I'm always thinking about things in Clarice Bean's way, because I suppose she's very in me anyway.
Look, I believe that we all learn more as we grow up and grow older, but I wonder, what do we sometimes leave behind?
I think adults so often forget what it feels like to be a child and have to go to school, and you're going to school on your own. And it doesn't matter how conscientious you are as a parent and how much you care, you can't go through their school day with them, and that how even the tiniest thing can make a very big impression. And I think sometimes want to forget, you know, the difficulties of being a child, and we can look back and say, oh, it's so wonderful, I wish I was a child again and had all that time. But actually, it's all hard work. You know, I think there are all those things that we all feel, and sometimes we try and shrug them off because it's a bit too scary to imagine you're that vulnerable. But I think we all are.
Lauren Child, the creator of Clarice Bean, Charlie and Lola, and about 1 billion laughs for children. Her latest book is Clarice Bean, Don't Look Now. Thank you so much, Ms.
Thank
Child.
You. Thanks.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.